then I'd ask that you please welcome Claire H. from Las Vegas, our speaker tonight.
Let me just crack this open. There we go. Oh, I didn't get to look. Okay. Hi, I'm Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey. And I love coming down here. Thank you, Lee, for contacting me 3 years ago and inviting me to come down and share. I've been in this area a couple of times with Lee, and I love coming down here. The pocket of enthusiasm, the welcoming, the great food. I mean, it just is always a joy to come down and be part of a fellowship or a community that has such love and is in such action for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just delightful, and I need you to know that it's not like that everywhere. So this is really special, and I hope you keep it going. Because I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is September 3rd, 1977, which means I celebrated 48 years last September. And what helps keep me on that path is that I have a sponsor. And my sponsor has more time than I have. She does more service than I do. And she sponsors more women than I do. And I'm not a slacker. But she keeps ahead of me. And what she's showing me through her own actions, through her own example, is that we don't retire from Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't get a certain age in sobriety and go, whew, now it's up to the next people. Because I have a daily reprieve from alcoholism. I have just a daily reprieve. And I need to be moving my sobriety. If my disease is progressing, I need to have a recovery that is progressing, which means I need to stay on the front line. I need to stay inconvenienced. Because it's when I get convenient, I get complacent. And if I get complacent, then it's your responsibility. I've already done it. You know, and then I start stepping away. And somebody explained to me once that relapse happens one bad decision at a time. I'm not going to that meeting tonight. I'm not going. It's cold. It's rainy. It's too hot. That's one for my area. And it's somebody else's time to go to a panel. You know, I've been doing that. I don't need to do that. And I really don't like that person. I don't like that person. And they go there. I'm not going to go. One by one, we start cutting out Alcoholics Anonymous. Or we have the opposite thing. I have gotten this amazing life as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I'm too busy. I'm too busy to take your phone call. I'm too busy to take a weekend to come, to travel. Or I'm too busy to go into that panel. I'm too busy. I'm too busy. I'm not giving out my phone number. And my story, which I hope to tell briefly, is about that. Is about stepping away and not drinking, but stepping away. Okay, I got sober very young, as you probably knew. But I did. I started drinking before I was legal to drink, and I sobered up at 21. And I sobered up as a result of somebody who had 1 year, but had been involved in the steps, involved in the literature, and understood that alcoholism had two manifestations. The first happens when I drink. Once I start drinking, I don't have an off switch, and I don't want one. I don't want one. I've never aspired to be a social drinker. Never wanted one. I want to drink until I get there. You know, our literature talks about we drink for the effect. Alcoholics, we drink for the effect. And the effect is there. I finally got there. And I can let it go. I can drop the noise in my head. I'm so awkward. I am so socially stunted. I have such a busy mind that all I think about is how you're thinking about me. And so it makes me socially awkward. I can't mix with people because what if I say the wrong thing? Then you won't like me, and then I can't come back. And then it's just busy, busy, busy. And if I could get there, that quieted down or went silent completely. Oh, I love that. You know, and that would be fine if I would stay there. But see, I have alcoholism. So I shoot past there to oops. You know, and I don't stop until I'm stopped, which means I've either run out of alcohol or I've passed out. I don't want to stop. I have an allergy. Some people like to talk about, it's an addiction. I'm not addicted to alcohol. I'm not. I have an allergy, which means that it doesn't matter how long I stay away from it. When I pick it up again, I will still have the allergy. It's kind of like if I was allergic to strawberries. If I don't eat strawberries, I don't break out in a rash. Yay. But if I just re-decide that this time it's going to be different because it's been 10 years since I had any strawberries, I'm going to break out into hives because I'm not addicted to strawberries. I have an allergy. And the allergy, for me, manifests in more. I need more. My favorite drink is more. I don't care what it is. I was a young alcoholic. I'm not drinking top shelf stuff, guys. You know, I'm drinking what I found in your closet. I just drink garbage. But it doesn't matter because if I can drink enough of it, I'll get there. And so that's what she identified. She knew that alcoholism was an allergy. But what was more important about our interaction is what happens when I don't drink. Because the second manifestation of alcoholism is the mental obsession. And that's what she saw, because she never saw me drink. But she heard me talking about it, romancing it, reliving it, anticipating it, planning. All my mental faculties were, when can I do it again? And I'm a periodic. I'm a young alcoholic. I don't have a lot of access to alcohol, but all I can think about is when can I do it again? And that's what she understood. And so she brought me to you guys. She didn't tell me she was bringing me to Alcoholics Anonymous. She asked me if I wanted to go with her. And so I thought I was going as support. You know, yes, I'll go sit with you while you go to your classes. And as before we went in, she said, okay, here's the rules. Sit down, shut up, and I'll talk to you about what goes on afterwards. So, okay, so the meeting started. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in the San Fernando Valley, so I lived in Los Angeles area, and the hole in the sky. And so we went upstairs and the hole in the sky, and you guys started talking, and my jaw dropped. I could not believe the things that you were saying. Did you have no pride? And I started to, you know, say, what are we doing here? And she said, shut up. I'll talk to you later. And people were sharing. I mean, they'd lost jobs. They'd lost families. They'd lost relationships. They'd lost... You know, all this stuff, I just kept seeing you as a bunch of losers. And at the end of the meeting, she asked me if I had identified. I said, no, why would you think I would? She said, let me cut to the chase. Claire, if I told you you could never have another drink, would you have a problem with that? I said, yeah, wait a minute, I'm going to have champagne at my wedding. She said, stop me if I'm wrong. You're not dating anyone. It's like, yeah, what does that have to do with anything? You know, I mean, she said, what are we talking about? The clinking of glass, the twining of arms, the sip? It's like, no, every wedding I'd ever been to was open bar, and I was looking forward to mine. You know, and she said, that's alcoholic thinking, where you put off taking action today because some unknown, distant event may happen, And she could have been, you know, Charlie Brown's mother for all I know. You know, because she's not saying anything that makes sense to me. Say, I don't know I've got alcoholism. I don't identify with you. In 1976, when I was brought into the rooms, the demographics in Alcoholics Anonymous were very different. A young person was in their late 30s to 40s. And I wasn't 21 at the time. I was 20. So how can I have what you have? I don't have what you have. But she was smart. And she had a directory for L.A. and the San Fernando Valley. And there, way back then, there were maybe 1,000 meetings. It was like a little phone book. Just, and she said, you go to any of these meetings. If you stay sober, you'll be welcome. And see, what I understand about alcoholism is that it's a lonely disease. And even at that young point, I was suffering from the loneliness. I don't drink like my friends. You know, I have to pre-drink. They go and they socialize. I hang out at wherever the bar is, wherever we've set up, because I started drinking at home parties. So I'm just hanging around there. Because I would have told them that I need it as a social lubricant, or, you know, I'm more comfortable with people once I've had a few drinks. But that's a lie. Because once I start drinking, I don't care about you. I just need this, and I'm going to keep this full. I don't set a drink down. Once it comes into my grip, I got it. I can pour. I don't need to put the glass down. You know, I don't know how to, you know, I don't know how to not, how do you show up? How do you do? And people that weren't comfortable with the way I drank, so I didn't drink around them. I pre-drank and I went. And then I drove. Because I got places to go. I got things to do. And so I took her directory. I took the directory. And I joined the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, no, she did put that caveat, if you don't drink. And I thought, no problem. I don't have to drink. You know? Whoa. And so your microphone is talking to me, or your speaker. It's making fun noises. Anyway, so I started hitting meetings. And I rarely went to the same meeting twice. So I'm just bouncing from meeting to meeting to meeting in LA, in the South Bay, up in the Valley, over here, over there. I'm just going. And again, I show up at a meeting and they look at me a little odd. One, I brought my absolute best barware clothing here, you know. I dressed appropriately for what I thought I was doing, hanging out with drunks. I will, you know, I know how to dress. And people would say to me, you're too young to be here. You haven't drank enough. But my friend said I could come. So I just smile and keep going. They said I didn't have the right motives to be there either, whatever that meant. And I just kept going. I just filed it away. Nothing changed. I'm sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really busy, and I'm having a blast, but I'm not doing anything to treat my alcoholism. If you're a real alcoholic, the problems in your life tend to show up after you stop drinking, when you're not taking your solution anymore, because and I didn't know it at that time. I didn't know that alcohol was my solution to all the irritability, restlessness, and discontent. But I'm not drinking anymore. And as time progresses, I am getting more and more irritated. And it's like a coil is tightening in my gut. And it just keeps cranking down and cranking down and cranking down. And what that looks like is your breathing bothers me. Do it somewhere else. You know, I'm just ready to explode. And I was in that irritable, restless, and discontent state. And what piece of information comes forward? The real alcoholics in the room said I wasn't one of them. And what insanity would it be for me to have stopped drinking if I'm not even an alcoholic? And then I latched onto that other thing. It said, if you're not sure you're an alcoholic, step up to a bar and have a drink. So I thought that was a great idea. So I stepped up to a bar. Actually, I got a date. And we were going to go for drinks. And I thought, okay, here's the thing. If I can have one drink, then I won't be an alcoholic. So that's what I set out to do, was to have one drink. So it's, okay, we have to do things differently, very differently. So he ordered me a drink. And as the waiter brought it to me, I let him put it on the table instead of intercepting it. No, I let him put it on the table. And I continued to listen to the guy talk about himself. And I watched my glass. And finally, I picked it up and I took a sip. Now, I'm not a sipper. I am a volume drinker. You know, I can show up to a meeting with a 20-ounce cup of coffee and a bottle of water for an hour meeting and go through both of them. I'm volume. And I had to put the drink down and take my hand off of it. And then I start looking around the room and I start to count. How frequently do you pick up a drink? 1, 2, 3, 4. Is 10 enough? If I set it on the table, 10's enough. Pick up, sip, put down, let go, count, watch. It's a very, very long date. But I walked out of that restaurant having had one drink and thought, thank God I'm not an alcoholic. So can you guess what I did for the rest of the evening? I drank. I went drinking. Because I had started the phenomenon of craving. I had activated the allergy and I needed more. And that set me on a 4-month run where I had come into Alcoholics Anonymous as a periodic and had just gone 10 months without a drink. Now I'm drinking 4 to 5 nights a week. And the only reason I did not become a daily drinker is because of rooms like this and people like you. Because what you told me was is that my best drinking was behind me. The fun, the joy, the whatever, that was gone. I was chasing the delusion that it would be like it was. And it wasn't. I couldn't catch that elusive feeling of, and that's what you talked about, that my best days were behind me, that this would only get more progressive. It would never get better. It would only get worse. And so in September 2nd, I had my last drink. I had gone out partying, and it was no worse. I mean, it was a night of debauchery. It was always a night of debauchery because I don't have any social boundaries when I drink. I'm willing to do anything for the next drink. So this was no worse than any other night, other than the fact that I started at a family party. See, I'm a sneak drinker. I'm going to do it behind your back. I'm not going to be out in the open about what I do, but there was a family party and the bar was in the kitchen and I never left the kitchen. I just stayed next to the alcohol. Family would come looking for me saying, the party's out there. Are you joining the party? No, no. What are you doing? Oh, I'm having a drink. That's a tumbler. What are you drinking? You know, they look at the barware over here and you're drinking out of an iced tea glass, 32 ounces. You know, A bottle of wine is a drink if you pour it in a 32-ounce glass. You know, I know how to work the math. But there was such disgust in their faces that I knew I'd picked the wrong place to drink. So I picked up my purse, got in the car, and went and found my people. And I drank, and I debauched, and I showed up the next morning, and there was that look of disgust. And I kind of got an inkling of what you were talking about with incomprehensible demoralization. Because I was seeing what I did through the eyes of people who loved me. I don't come from an alcoholic family. I am the alcoholic in my family. So they weren't used to this. And I had enough remorse and guilt to take some action. And I called a member and I said, please meet me Friday. You know, if you'll meet me in Los Angeles Friday. If you're not available to meet me, I'll be drunk. And the guy met me. And I wanted him to tell me the same things that I'd always been told. You're too young. This is youthful indiscretion drinking. You'll grow out of it. You know, all teens, you know, do this. You'll grow out of it. And he didn't say any of that. He said, I can't tell you whether you're an alcoholic or not, but if alcohol is interrupting your inability, is causing you the inability to show up and be present in your life the way you want to, then you know what to do and you know what to go, where to go. I didn't think he was very helpful. I really wanted him to tell me I wasn't one. On the way home from LA, I am the only person in my car. And I held a business meeting for all the people in my head. The committee showed up. And the topic for that business meeting was whether or not I was an alcoholic. Because, you know, now I'm 21. I've finally become legal to drink. And it's my right, because I'm now 21, to drink. And it's getting loud. There's screaming. There's yelling. There's swerving. I could see furniture flying back and forth. But I was screaming at the top of my lungs. I am not an alcoholic. I can take it or leave it at any point in time. It's no big deal, was the chant from me. And this quiet voice showed up and said, well, if it's no big deal, then just never take another drink. And it'll be no big deal. I had what the book talks about, that moment of clarity, that I could no more not pick up another drink than I could park that car and fly the rest of the way home. And so I took step one. As I admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I followed it up with, and my life is now over. But I went back to AA. I don't know at what point. If you're new and there were wonderful new people, welcome, welcome. I hope you stay. I hope you catch this thing. If you don't think you have it, hang around. It's contagious. You'll get it. No? But I hope you hear something that brings you back. As when I wasn't paying attention. See, I came back and I did what I'd done 10, 14 months earlier. I joined the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I joined a club there. It was the Torrance Lamita Club. And the Torrance Lamita Club, the Manhattan Club, the Hermosa Club, the Redondo Club, they each took a different Saturday, like you do up here for speaker meetings. I'm sure there was a meeting before it, but there was a dance after it. And so I was hitting all the dances. And then there was volleyball on the beach, and there was potlucks, and there was this, and softball, and I joined the fellowship. And I want you to know that you can stay sober on the fellowship, but it leaves you hungry. And I looked at your steps. I looked at them. And I thought, wow, I'm sure glad you guys have all of those. But I don't need that. I don't need all of that. I liked up to the dash. You admit you were powerless over alcohol. There you go. All right, I'm in an AA meeting. There must be some powerlessness. Okay, my life had become unmanageable? No. See, I think the problem is drinking. I'm not drinking. No problem. So I skipped that. I'd been raised in a religious household, so I didn't need two or three. And I liked the idea of four because the world and its folks had done me wrong. And I looked forward to telling you about it. But I had those 90 dances to get in first. And who cares about the rest? I don't want a sponsor. I'm not somebody who likes to be watched. I really don't like to be watched. And sponsors seemed like they would be paying attention. So I don't want one of those. And I can see, because I've heard your stories, you really do need some guidance. Not me. I'm okay. And I went on my way. And I don't have any guidelines. I have not picked up the kit of spiritual tools. I've not done anything but stop drinking. And I found the people in the rooms that also didn't have sponsors and also weren't working the steps and thought this was a dating club. Like me. You know, I had always wanted to be popular. And I was. And the upshot of it was I fell into bad company and I was raped. By somebody who was hanging out at AA meetings. Was he an alcoholic? I don't know. I really don't. He could have been. Or he could have just been a predator, hanging out in the rooms, looking for vulnerable people, looking for people on the fringes. And I was about as far on the fringes as you could get. I don't have any girlfriends here. You know? Why? No, I don't have a sponsor. I'm not working the steps. Nothing's changing. I'm not drinking. You're offering me a good time, I'm gone. And so they used to talk about this thing in the meetings. They would talk about it. They called it the 13th step. And everybody would laugh. Oh my God, they would laugh. And they'd say, watch that step, it's a doozy. You know, this, that, the next. And I had to tell you, when it happened to me, it wasn't funny. It wasn't a blast. And it took me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was mortified, and I left, and I went into therapy, and I did some good work in therapy in the beginning to deal with that assault. But see, I have alcoholism, and I need some release from it, so I stayed in therapy for 20 years. Once a week, 50 minutes, I could talk about me. And in those days, John and I were talking about this, in those days, you could talk all you wanted. Just talk. If I just talked through it, if I just understood, if I just examined, if I just had enough self-knowledge, everything would be fine. But nothing changed. Nothing changed. I met my husband not long after that incident, and what a steady rock. What an absolute gem of a man that just landed in my path. And he and I married, and we started working together, and we're climbing that ladder, and we're doing, and we're going, and the 80s were amazing. They were just great. And I had a big social job, and God, it was great. You know, it was great. Bought houses, you know, we're doing that thing. The American dream, yay. Somewhere in the 90s, it changed. I left that very social job, and now I'm doing a job that's remote, so I'm not having as much interaction. My husband, who's an amazing provider, is working 60, 80 hours a week, so he's not around. And I started slowly sliding, but it was so slow, I didn't catch it. But my therapist is talking about my family of origin and how dysfunctional they are. And I am agreeing, absolutely agreeing. They are. My mother is the wicked witch, and this one is that, and that one's in the, and you never have to talk to them. I would think you know, they're toxic, and it would be better for you if you didn't have contact. Yay! Family's gone. And then those friends, you know, they would talk to me. We would talk about things, and I would give them my best advice, because I'm in therapy. I would give them my best advice, and they weren't taking it. Well, why did you waste my time? If you're not going to do what I say, why bother me? So you're gone. And by 1999, I had pushed away my entire world. I'm living in my house. I'm not agoraphobic. I just don't have any reason to leave. I do my job, I report remotely, and I'm reading romance novels because now I'm looking for a happy ending. I'm looking for something where it works out. I don't know what it is. And one day, I was sitting on my couch, surveying my world, and I thought, you know what? I have arrived. I have everything that people said would make me happy. I've got a husband who loves and adores me. I've got a well-paying job. He's got a better-paying job. I've got a house on the hill, the car I always want to drive in the driveway, money in the bank, jewelry in the vault. I've got it. And I've also got enough prescription medication in the house to kill myself, and that's the plan. Because if I've got everything that I ever thought I needed to make me happy, and I am in this much emotional pain, I don't want to live anymore. See, when I had that rape, God and I parted ways, big time. Not going to keep me safe. I'm not talking to you. I didn't even know I'd made that agreement. I just stopped. I'm not talking to you. And what steps in when you don't have God reliance is self-reliance. And if you define self-reliance, it is that you don't take input from other people. You are not open to other people's input, suggestions, direction. So, if I can't see a way out of my situation, and I am relying on me, then there isn't a way out. And therefore suicide, sober suicide, becomes the next viable option. And I was counting up pills to kill myself, and that quiet voice showed back up and said, why don't you go to a meeting first? One meeting. I thought, well, I can always come back and kill myself. You know, nothing's going to change, but I'll go. Just that much willingness. One meeting, one action. And I will stand here and tell you my entire life changed. One action. Because the secretary of that meeting was doing her job. What she was doing, she was practicing tradition 5. She was carrying out her primary purpose. She was sober, and she was looking for the still suffering alcoholics. And she got there early and set it up, and she was watching. And I came through the door. Now, a lot of times that suffering alcoholic is the one that's new. They're shaking out alcohol. They're trying to find a new way of living and wondering, can it happen here? Can I really have a different way of living? And yes, you can. But that day, it wasn't the newcomer. I had 22 years away from a drink and was ready to die. After the meeting, you know, she kind of kept her eye on me, and because I show up just before the meeting starts. I, you know, don't want to get there too soon. But I would split the minute the meetings were over. So she knew she had to be quick. And she positioned herself for the closing prayer. And when I went to leave, she clamped down on my hand. And I thought she just forgot to let go. So I'm jerking my hand, trying to get it out. She clamped down on it again, and she turned and she said, you don't look so good. Are you doing all right? And I went into my whine about how hard life was, and nobody would talk to me, and I couldn't find a sponsor, and it's so tough. And he said, wait a minute, don't you have a lot of time? I said, yeah, I have 22 years. She said, well, isn't that time you started giving something back to AA instead of sucking it dry like you have been? And if you want a sponsor, what are you doing in daytime meetings? You need to get to night meetings. That's where the sponsors are. They have jobs. If you want somebody to talk to, why don't you get here 20 minutes before the meeting starts or stay 20 minutes after? Why don't you start putting your hand out to somebody else instead of waiting for somebody to come up to you? Why do I always see you sitting there waiting for somebody to pour you a cup of coffee? Why don't you get off your butt and pour a cup of coffee for somebody else? And that coffee cup you left sitting on the table, that needs to be washed. I suggest you pick up your coffee cup and all the other ones that were left on the table and go out to the bar and wash them. And then she got nasty. And she said, there's a woman's meeting. Meets Tuesday night, 6:30, Trinity Lutheran Church. I will be there. I suggest you show up. And although 1,000 comebacks ran through my mind, the only thing that came out my mouth was okay. Because that day, I was out of plans. I didn't have another way out. And so I went to the meeting, and thank God, what she did is she directed me to a Three Legacy Week meeting. And she probably mentioned it. But since I didn't know what one legacy was, it didn't matter what three were. But what it meant is that the women in that meeting had taken the steps and were actively taking others. So there was active sponsorship going on there. And they knew that our unity was what we needed above all else, you know, beyond our sobriety. If we can't find a way to hang together and have some principles to keep us unified, we'll die individually. So they practiced and taught the traditions. And then they realized that I had no skin in this game. None. I had no reason to come back after that one meeting. And so they did the third legacy, which is they put me in service. They had me picking up books. They had me picking up people. They had me picking up cigarette butts from the parking lot. Hauling chairs, stacking tables. I mean, they always seemed to have something. And they never asked me if I wanted to do it. They just said do it. Because I frequently said, no, I didn't want to do it. Wasn't there with someone with much less time than I had available to do that? And they said, shut up and do it. And so I did. And they took a directory and they circled the meetings that they wanted me to go to. They said, we will meet you at each one of this, and you never again have to walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous alone unless you choose to. And they met me at every meeting. And they showed me through their actions how to live this program. I didn't know how to live this program. I had been sober for 22 years, which means to me that I haven't been drinking for 22 years. That's sobriety. You're not drinking, you're sober. Recovery, on the other hand, is work. And that's where the freedom comes in. The freedom from the bondage of self comes in. Through working the steps, reaching out to others. I'm selfish and self-centered at my core. My literature tells me it's the root of my problem is the selfishness and self-centeredness, which means I will have it until I die. But it's going to morph and it's going to change. It's not always going to look the same. So again, it's a reprieve that I have from self by being part of you, showing up and being inconvenienced. That's where I grow. And that's when I get relief of me. Because it's all here, it's all here, it's all here. And I do service and I, oh, you, look. I heard it described so perfectly once. I was saying that his sponsor pointed out and said, do you see those shapes out there? Those things that are in your way? You know, those things you have to push aside to get where you're going? He said, yeah. And he said, those are people. And I thought, oh God, people, no. Because you're just in my way. I can't make eye contact with you. I'm looking down at the ground. Get out of my way. Service gives me other vision. I worked through the steps. I got very busy. You know, I couldn't understand why it took me 22 years. I'm only grateful it did. That I didn't go to the end of my life, which could have been at 22 years, thinking I had done Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, that didn't work. You know, no sponsor, no steps, no home group, no commitments. That's sobriety. I needed to be introduced to recovery, and I got very busy. And my life started to change. I started to grow in a different direction. And I started to, you know, I went through all the steps, and then I started living in 12. Is when I want to, I've had that spiritual awakening. I've reconnected with that God. I've cleared away the wreckage of my past. I've made amends to my family. I'm restored to my family. You know, I found out that the dysfunction in my family was me. You know, not that they're perfect by any shakes, but I was a common denominator with all of them. And so I've done that, and then I've tried to grow in my understanding and effectiveness and grow my spiritual concept so that I can live these principles in all my affairs. Getting sober, getting into recovery was to return me to society, not to have me hide out. I need to participate in the world that I'm part of and keep anchored in Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to do it. So I'd like to tell you what's gone on for the last couple of years. It's been a wild ride. In 2022, I was preparing to attend the Unity in Service conference up in Pleasant Hill. Now, it was hybrid, high hybrid people. It was hybrid, and I had everything set up, and I was ready to listen. I was so excited. It just happened. It's a wonderful conference, and it basically focuses on, at that point, traditions and concepts, you know, growing your understanding there. So I was all excited, and my mother called, and she said, I believe your brother's drinking. My brother, who had 22 years clean. He's walking into walls, he's slurring, if he falls down, he can't get up, I have to call the police or somebody to help get him up, and he fell, and I can't get him up, and he won't let me call the police, and I'm not living this way. You know, she was 93. She's like, I can't live with this, you have to come down and get him out. But I'm gonna go to this conference. I got things to do, and, you know, I've planned this, and this is inconvenient. And that little voice said, oh, so you'd rather sit and listen to doing 12-step work than do it. It's like, gosh darn it. Okay. Said, why don't we do a health and welfare check, you know, call the police, do a health and welfare check. I'll be there in 6 hours. Because my mom lives in Redondo Beach and I live in the Bay Area. But I'll be there as soon as I can. So I start packing a bag and one thing and another. An hour later, I call the hospital because he's been taken. And I say, and I had said to mom, make sure they do a talk screen. We need to know what he's on. And I got the doctor on the phone and he said, why'd you have me do a drug screen? I said, history, just, you know. He said, well, here's the good news. Your brother doesn't have any drugs or alcohol in his system. I said, wow. And he said, and that's the end of the good news. So we don't quite know what's wrong, but your brother is very sick. I said, well, I'll be there in about 5 hours. And he said, oh, great. Fabulous. I'll talk to you then. We'll have much more information. So I drove down and I met with the doctors, and it turned out that my brother had undiagnosed glioblastoma. Progressive, and which is a brain cancer that originates in the brain, A lot of brain cancer comes from cancer somewhere else in your body and it travels, but glioblastoma, and it's fatal. There's no... And I had to go home and tell my mother. Doug's dying. And my sister had flown in and from Florida, and my younger brother was there, and I told them all. And I explained everything the best I could. And my mother is crying, you know, everybody is trying to grapple with what I'm saying. And my brother said, I so appreciate you coming and telling us and sharing what's going on, but you need to know that we have turned Doug's care over to you, and we are going to trust that you will be the best advocate for him, and you'll let us know what you need us to do. The black sheep of the family. And I did that, and I had to make those decisions and make those choices, and I moved into a hospice house, and he was gone in 5 days. From diagnosis to death. And I had to then plan and do and put together and carry. And it had already been a tough year because my husband had had problems and this one had had problems. And I was spending all my time racing back and forth between LA and, you know, home. And now this. I rolled into, I got it done. And I rolled into the State Line Retreat, which is happening this weekend in Las Vegas. I rolled into that and I was talking to a friend, and because she was acting like a guide person, you know, just kind of walking me around because I just couldn't. I was so confused all the time. I had a new car and I backed it into a closed garage door because I thought I'd opened the door, you know? I mean, I'm just not tracking. And I said to a friend, I said, I think I need to work the steps again. I'm not tracking. I can't keep, I don't know what's going on. And this friend said, are you open to a suggestion? Sure. She said, this is what I suggest for people who have time. That they kind of take a new look at the steps. I said, okay. And she said, I want you to write a list of everything you're powerless over. Not new. She said, just do it, everything that you're powerless over. And she said, and then I want you to put next to those items what you do when you forget you're powerless. Oh. And then for step two, I want you to write the story you tell yourself to justify taking action where you are powerless. Because if you do that, you will see insanity. And once you get a grip on how insane you are, you can have a different conversation with God. And I did that. And I took that to my sponsor and I did the rest of the steps, and that's when it became amazingly clear that self-reliance is my number one character defect. When challenged or confronted, I go into default survival mode. And it wasn't that I wasn't talking to God. It was, okay, we got a lot to do, let's go. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I did this and this and this and this and this and this and this. So I'm reporting. I never pause to ask. I'm doing. And I'm getting further and further away from the source because my fears and my anxieties are stepping in between us. And so when I got down to 7, I was getting on my knees. And I started saying the 7-step prayer, but I changed the words. I said, you know, God, I'm willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. Remove from me anything that stands in the way of my usefulness. Now it says, remove the character defect that stands in the way. So I may have, you know, and I'm a paraphraser, I'm not a quoter. You know, so that anything that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out to do your bidding, with love, kindness, tolerance, and patience. Your will, not mine, be done. I ran that by my spiritual advisor, and he went, ooh, you really say that? That's going to be interesting, Claire. That's going to be interesting. So I started doing that probably, I'll say it was June. In August, I was asked to speak in Las Vegas. So I went to Saudis, and I've always had this fear that if I was ever put in the ground, if I was ever buried and had a headstone, it would say she didn't plan to fail, she just failed to plan. You know, because what if something else comes up? I don't want to make a plan. And so I had decided to act against that nature, and that I made a plan to meet with somebody. And she was saying, you know, you and Don are here all the time. I don't see why you don't move here. I said, oh, God, there's no way in hell I'd move to Las Vegas. And I gave her my laundry list. And she said, you know, I really think your view of Las Vegas is the Strip. She said, would you be open to me showing you my vet Las Vegas? And we had a couple of days, and we were just talking about a couple hours. She said, sure. She said, if you could have a dream home, what would it look like? And so we came up with some stuff. And she started showing us this other part of Vegas that we didn't even know existed. And we found this house. Well, actually, we found this really nice plot of dirt. But the model that would have gone on that plot of dirt was really cool. And my nails grew, and I kind of climped around. And I would say to my, take your nails out of that, take your nails out of those house, we're not moving. I have, the Tri-Valley where I lived was a pocket of enthusiasm like you guys have. And I could walk into the room and I would see people that I'd been seeing for the 25 years that I'd been back in the rooms and active. And there's just a sense of ease and comfort when you walk in the room and you go, oh, you're still here. And you're still, okay, my peeps are here. Why would I leave that? And I'm actively involved in San Quentin. You know, I do H&I. That is my niche. That is my foundation. And I've been doing that for 12 years. I don't want to leave the guys. I've got too much going on, but then there's this. And I just Don's like, you know, if we're gonna do this, we gotta act because it's a new development. That dirt lot will be gone. And I was talking to that same friend and I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, Claire, why don't you ask God to bless it or block it? She's from Texas. I love Texans. I love Texans. Get out of your region, you know, and you get all these new insights, you know, and she's my out-of-region girl. And I said, bless it or block it? Okay. Block it, block it, block it, block it, block it, block it. Bless it if you have to, but block it, block it, block it, block it, block it. And things started happening, like, okay, we're talking to an agent and your house is going to be sold by November and you know by Thanksgiving you'll be out, and but my other house isn't going to be ready until June or July. And I was doing my due diligence and I was talking to a woman who had moved. I wanted to see how she'd done it. How was it to move? And I said, "Well, I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be homeless." And she said, "You're not going to be homeless." I said, "Yeah, no. You don't have a home. That's called homeless." And she said, you'll just move into my house. I said, I didn't know you were renting your house. She said, I didn't say anything about renting it. I said, move in. I got extra room. Just move in whenever you need it. Keys under the mat. Because I was thinking that was a block. Because I didn't want to be homeless. I didn't want to have my stuff somewhere and me somewhere and that somewhere. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then there was a financial thing, and it was going to be, wait, you know, we had the money, but, you know, tax-wise and this, and I looked at Don, and I said, this is it, honey. We're just not meant to be. This is it. And he said, you know, we can, you know, call. And I was scheduled to have pedicure with a friend of mine who I had worked for and retired from her practice. And We went to have pedicures and we're sitting in the lobby of the pedicure salon, and we're not talking about this. We're just chatting about her. And she said, oh, by the way, I'm going to write you a check for $100,000. I just figured, I thought, you know what? You would probably be able to make this move a little better if you had $100,000 extra sitting in your account. And then when the house sells, just pay me back. What? She said, what, is it not enough? No, wait, what? She said, well, I know you've never asked me for the money. It's like, you got that right. She said, go ahead, do it. She says, I'm leaving the country for 6 months. Just let me know. And I came to the point that God had a better plan for me, and that my time in California was over. And that for some reason, I was needed in Las Vegas. God help us all. And so I started, and God's perfect timing showed up, as it does, you know, when you're trying to do that will, when you're trying to align with what is. And 2 weeks before I was about to move, I got a call from one of my mother's doctors. She's now 95. And they said, yeah, we admitted your mom to check her lungs. I said, yes, I know. And she said, so we're going to be releasing her in a couple days. I said, okay. And we're putting her on hospice and she needs 24-hour care. Wait, what? Wait a minute, she walked herself into you guys. What do you mean you're putting her on hospice? What did you do while she was there? And they said, she has advanced COPD, and when she stands, her heart rate escalates and her breathing pump function drops. And she passes out. She can't be left alone. And all I wanted to say is, but I'm moving. I gotta get and go. And but see, I've been through these traditions. And I know that our family is part of the common welfare that I'm part of. And so I called my brother and my sister. And my sister said, don't worry about it. I'll take a plane. I'll get there. I'll stay with mom while you move. And we'll work it out. And so I started doing that. And I would be 2 weeks in L.A. and back and unpack, and 2 weeks in L.A. and back and unpack, and 2 weeks in L.A. And she died in July. And I walked, you know, I got to walk her home and do all the things. I've lost my brother. I've lost my community, my fellowship, and my mom. But my feet are trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I started going, I kept going to meetings. I kept reaching out. I kept contact with my sponsor. I was running everything by because I couldn't always think clearly. And Alcoholics Anonymous carried me through that. And it continues to. I need to be going to different meetings because I'm seeking my fellowship. You know, I'm seeking peers where I am. But the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is loud and clear. Stay in service to me, and I'll take care of the details. And I have a whole 25, 26 years of experience of staying close to God and having all the details worked out in a way that I could not have planned. I truly believe that God has created a path for each one of us. I know some people say plan, but I call it a path because that means it's already been laid. I just need to walk it. Plans can shift. Plans, paths are laid there. And my job is to fit myself to be of maximum service, which means I need to get out of me. I need to come see you. I'm so grateful to be here and to have an opportunity to share with you my journey. And thank you for being so gracious and for listening.
Thank you, Claire. We really appreciate you coming out from Las Vegas and sharing with us. So let's give her another hand.